This is Paul Revelard speaking. On the 29th of September, 1981, today I'm talking with Ken Atho, J. Kenneth Atho, better known as Ken, who was born in Lime Rock.
No.
So, where were you born?
I'll correct that.
Yes, okay, where were
I
you
born? I was born in Great Barrington.
Born in Great Barrington.
Massachusetts.
You lived there for how long?
Well, approximately 3 years. My father was organist at the Episcopal Church in Great Barrington. And when I was about 3 years old, which would bring it to about 1909, my dad had to find more lucrative employment than giving music lessons and playing the organ in the church. So he took a job with the Barnum & Richardson Company in Lime Rock as their paymaster. And
here's the book that you...
So it was approximately 1909 that I began my life in Lime Rock.
And your father was employed for how many years at Barnum & Richardson?
Well, he was employed with the Barnum & Richardson Company until approximately 1919. These are estimates, of course, because I have no notes or anything to go from. But the Barnum Richardson Company went bankrupt, I guess it was, and they reformed under the Salisbury Iron Corporation. This was just about wartime. Then my father lost his job, and fortunately the high school needed an assistant business manager. So Harry Jones came down and asked him if he would take the job, and it worked out very nicely for him.
I can recall when he was business manager at Hotchkiss. During the early days of Barnum & Richardson, what did they make, Ken? What?
Well, they had two foundries on the river, one north of the Lime Rock Lodge, which is now an apartment building, and one farther down the river on the south of the lodge. The one north of the lodge, which was at the dam, which in those days was much higher than the present dam, they made car wheels, railroad car wheels. That was the car wheel shop. The car wheel foundry was on the east side of the river. The old mill, the pattern shop, was on the west side of the river.
When you say pattern shop, was that the pattern from which the car wheels were made?
Right. This is where they made the wooden patterns, which they used to form their molds for the
These were clay molds?
No, these were wooden,
the molds,
wooden patterns, yeah. But the molds were tamped sand, what they call molding sand. It was mixed with some sort of a binder, so that when it was tamped in a moist form, it became very hard and stable.
Was that dried or left in a damp condition?
That was left in a damp condition. And it was made in two or more sections so that the upper part of the mold could be lifted off, the pattern taken out, the mold put back together again with the pour holes in the top and vent holes to let the gases out as the molten iron flowed in.
So you had a wooden mold around the outside, or a wooden frame.
A wooden frame.
And the tamped
sand solidly
was
with sand.
Yeah. These are pretty accurate, or did they have to be returned or retreated in any way after they're removed from the mold?
They were finished on lathes after they left Lime Rock.
Oh, after.
Both to be fitted onto the axles and also the running rim, the portion that ran on the rails was trued up.
It would have to be flat wheels, wouldn't
it? Right.
Now those car wheels, I understand it, were very successful, and they made literally thousands of them. They went all over the country. Is that true?
That's true. This ore, which we had in Ore Hill and in this area, was apparently a very good grade of ore, which made a malleable iron. It was more resilient than some of the iron from other parts of the country, and it was particularly suited for railroad car wheels, apparently. And the Barnum Rissen Company were the largest producers of railroad car wheels for many years because of this.
Now, when you say that iron was particularly suited for car wheels, do you mean that it had a certain resilience because it was malleable to a certain degree?
Yes.
Instead of being extremely hard, it had a certain resilience. And
right.
It was good.
It was not as brittle, shall we say, chippable, as some of the cast iron from other areas of the country. In the lower foundry, they molded many different objects, castings, perhaps typical. One is a frog.
Well, I know what it is, but maybe you would explain what it is.
It's a doorstop, actually. It's something that they played with more than anything else. It was not one of their real products, but someone had made a mold in the shape of a frog, and they made a few castings of it, and it became very popular, and they produced quite a few of them.
Well, that isn't at all what I thought that was going
right.
to be.
All right,
you said a frog, I thought it was a railroad frog that went on the rails that shifted the train from one track to another.
I'm trying to recall some of the things that that they did make.
Did they make it?
No, they didn't make axles down there. They didn't make anything as heavy as that in the lower foundry. They made many washers, cast iron washers, such as we used to use for quoits. We used to pitch them like they pitch horseshoes today. But they were made for very heavy construction as a washer under the head of a heavy tie rod nut. Many of the railroad cars in those days, the freight cars, were made of wood. And they were put together with, essentially bolts, but they were long rods threaded on each end and a heavy nut and a washer holding the wooden sections together.
Were those washers made from bar stock and then the hole punched out can or drilled out?
No, they were cast.
They were cast, wow.
In fact, everything that was produced in Lime Rock in those days was cast. There was no steel, and there was no malleable iron produced. By malleable iron, I guess I mean that kind of iron that can be heated and bent and twisted and turned and things of this sort. This is my impression of a malleable iron. These were all cast iron products. Cast iron being brittle, of course, and not manipulable. What's the word I want to say? Manipulatable?
Yeah, that's good enough. Well, now, get back just a little bit. At the earliest, your earliest recollection of Barnum and Richardson, was there anything left, or were there any personalities around who knew anything about the old iron days when they made cannonballs and so forth in Lime Rock?
Well,
from your recollection, did you ever speak with anyone who?
No. As a matter of fact, I don't think they made cannonballs in Lime Rock. I could be wrong, because
they did test them there.
It was before any recollection of mine.
It was the old Ames Company?
The old Ames Company was over in Falls Village.
Oh, that was Falls Village.
And they made cannonballs over there.
Oh, that's what.
They also made cannons over there.
Oh, that was it.
But that operation had ceased before I came into the area.
Well, what, in your opinion, put Barnum and Richardson out of business? You said they went bankrupt.
Well,
the proximity of steel to Pittsburgh or something like that?
No, it was the difficulty in mining the ore, getting the ore out. Mines in Ore Hill had become so deep that they were continually being flooded by groundwater, which seeped in, and for a long time they tried to keep ahead of it with pumps, but it got to the point where pumps just could no longer take care of the inflow of the water.
So they were put out of business for lack of material, actually.
Well, that's right.
Now, to get back to those early days again, was the ore actually smelted in Lime Rock to obtain the iron that they used there in the manufacture of car wheels?
Yes.
It was smelted.
Now, the smelting was done farther up the river.
Is that the old
in what site? We call Upper Lime Rock, which is now the preserved iron furnace. Now, there they mixed iron ore, charcoal, lime, and coke to purify the iron, melt the iron out, and made pigs out of it. And this they called pig iron. And this was the raw cast iron.
Now, that the pigs in turn were remelted, brought to a molten state, and then poured into the forms that made the car wheels.
They
so
were,
that brings the whole picture then of Lime Rock in that era. That brings that whole picture together, doesn't it?
Right, yeah.
How the material came in, how it was prepared through smelting, how then it was remelted from the pigs, and poured into the molds to make the car.
There was also a mix of scrap iron with the pigs to make the best iron. They used a certain proportion of old scrap iron with the new iron of the pigs.
Because the new iron was too pure, is that right?
Well, apparently.
Too pure, too soft.
Apparently the scrap iron, which had already been processed and used for other purposes, had a a quality which new cast iron hadn't developed for some reason or other. This is beyond my knowledge as far as chemistry and so forth is concerned, of course, but there was always a big scrap pile at both the car wheel foundry and the lower foundry with which they charged the furnaces along with new pig iron.
That way they got a continuous mix that they were satisfied with.
Right.
That's very interesting.
My first recollection of Lime Rock, of course, was that it was a beehive of activity all along the river.
That's a little hard to understand
it
these
is.
Days, isn't it?
It is. But you had everything there that made up a village. Starting in Upper Lime Rock, you had the foundry, or the blast furnace, rather, which made the pig iron from the raw ore. The Barnum Rich & Company's office was originally up in Upper Lime Rock. And then it came down to the car wheel foundry on the east of the river, taking power from the dam, water power. On the west of the river was the grain mill, the old grist mill.
Also run by water power.
Also run by water power. The pattern shop, where patterns were made. The Lime Rock Lodge, with the general store next to it. A little further down the river were the blacksmith shop, a sawmill down below the foundry, the foundry itself. The post office was in the general store. Then by the time I had come to Lime Rock, they had moved their office from up in Upper Lime Rock, what was then known as Hopper Town, down to the building across from Lime Rock Lodge. Which later became Al Stone's real estate office. And throughout the town, of course, were many homes owned by the Barnum Richardson Company that they made available to their key employees.
At the height of that operation that you told about how many people would you say were gainfully employed at resulting from the car wheel operation?
Well, of course, this is going to be very much a guess.
Sure.
However, my recollections would be approximately 10 people in the car wheel foundry. Four or five in the pattern shop. The grist mill was run by someone else. Whether that was leased out to somebody or not, I don't know. But anyway, the grist mill was not a part of the Barnum Rich & Company operations. The blacksmith shop was independently operated by a blacksmith. The sawmill there again, I'm not sure what the connection was, but the sawmill always seemed to have four or five men available, but the lower foundry probably employed more than any of the others. And I would guess there are probably 15 at least, maybe more, steadily employed in the lower foundry.
At that time, were both the Barnum family and the Richardson family residing in Lime Rock? Did you have any knowledge of them?
Yes, I don't know. I don't remember William Barnum.
He was quite a politician, as I recall.
Yes. And he died shortly after we came to Lime Rock. Milo Richardson was living in Lime Rock at the time, and it was his father that was the Richardson of the Barnum Richardson Company. Richard Barnum lived on the White Hollow Road. He was of the second generation. Then there were some Richardsons that lived in what was most recently the General Semantics, Institute of General Semantics, there in the corner.
Was George Richardson connected with the original Richardson family? Was he a scion of that family?
George
Richardson, who married...
George Sawallis.
George Sawallis married a Barnum. Marjorie Richardson.
Right.
Yes. And she was of the original Richardson family and
right.
lived off the main road up on the hill.
She was Milo and Edith Richardson's daughter.
She would be a granddaughter.
So she would be a third generation of the
original
Richardsons.
Yeah. So they're the last members of the family to leave Lyman.
She was approximately my age. Philo Lyons was a grist mill operator at one time.
Was he later postmaster?
And he was later postmaster. He built the little general store up on the hill after the Boardman and Amundsen moved over to Lakeville. He opened a little general store there on the main street and took the post office on it.
Now, Ken, because the tape probably has moving right along, that pretty well covers the car wheel industry. What do you know of the paper factory? It was the Dard Hunter? What was the name of that?
Dard Hunter
paper.
Was a real authority on handmade paper. He had researched a lot of it. He'd written several books about it. And he was interested in preserving the handmade paper industry or reviving the handmade paper industry in this country. He brought a family from England to give it the expertise that was needed to make the paper. The Beach family came from out in Illinois somewhere, out around Michigan, I guess it was. And they took over the management of it. Dard Hunter very, very seldom came to Lime Rock. He spent very little time there. But he provided the money and the knowledge and laid out the mill on a small scale as his research had indicated that the handmade paper industry had operated. The family from England that came over was the Robertson family. The father's name was Bob Robertson. He had two sons, Reggie and Tom, and a daughter, Gladys. Gladys was engaged to, yeah. Going back, the family of the Robertsons consisted of Bob Robertson, his two sons, Reggie and Tom, and a daughter, Gladys, who was engaged to a man by the name of Leonard Gotti. And Gladys would not accompany them, apparently, unless they brought her boyfriend along. So Leonard Gotting was one of the family that Dart Hunter brought over to run the paper mill and do the actual paper making. So it was a very interesting process. And
it went on for a few years, as I understand it?
Yes. And I worked with them almost from the time they started to get the place ready until they finally had to fold it up. But one of the main problems was the fact that the building was so impregnated with foundry dust, sawdust, dirt in general, that even though they tried to seal all the ceilings, there was a very heavy vibration from what they called the knotter in the process of screening the fibers, that the knotter just shook the building to the point where all this dust was seeping down, and it got into the paper and became specks, black specks in paper which otherwise was would have been good paper, and they had to discard so much of it because of this dirt that became a very unprofitable operation. It is my understanding that this was the main reason that they had to discontinue the operation.
At about what year was that discontinued?
Well, now you see we're getting into
just a guess.
Years again. I was I was probably 20 years old, 19.
25, 26, maybe 27,
somewhere in there.
Yeah. Now that gives us a pretty good idea of the old industries in Lime Rock, Ken.
Then,
which
of course,
brings you up to the young manhood. Now, when you finished, when you became a young man, what did you do with yourself outside of going in the army and getting married,
course,
and raising a family and all?
Back in those days, we had problems getting to school, for one thing. Of course, another of the industries in Lime Rock, at Lime Rock Station, was the Borden milk factory. There was a milk train that came up through every morning and back at night. And when I started high school, the only way we had to get to high school was walk down to Lime Rock Station, which was about a mile, take the milk train to Canaan, And after school, we caught the return of the milk train to Lime Rock, and then walked another mile back home.
And how many years
to
did
the
you
Lime
do
Rock
that?
Station? Well, of course, my older sisters did it for quite a number of years. I did it for 2 years. And then a friend of my dad's gave us a horse and a buggy and a sleigh and a saddle. So I decided I'd go to high school in Lakeville, using the horse and buggy as transportation in the summer, sleigh in the winter, and so forth.
So well, that almost brings me into the picture. Did or did you not ride over from Lime Rock to Lakeville with a character by the name of Dinty Eggleston?
I sure did. Great many times. He rode with me. We did that for 1 year.
Park your horse across from what is now the Lakeville Post Office in a shed across
right,
the way.
That's right. And after the first year, it became a little more difficult. I decided that I was going to take a correspondence course in electricity rather than go back to the final year of high school. My dad was then assistant business manager at Hotchkiss School. Hotchkiss School let me have a room and work in the powerhouse while I was studying electrical engineering. And when I finished the course, I went into business with Jerry Dower in Canaan, in the electrical business. I don't know if it's necessary to go into that, though. That was a mistake.
So there on, there you went into the Army, or you were married. And,
Of course, I was with Jerry Dower in the electrical business for several years, and then I went to work for the Suburban Propane Gas Corporation, which was then Philgas. I worked for them as a salesman for 5 years. Then my dad died. I was offered his job at Hotchkiss School. I worked there for 5 years, and then I was drafted in the Army. And when I came out of the Army, I went into the Home Service Corporation in Salisbury.
That's when I worked for you for a short period of time, and I went down to Torrington and sold refrigerators to the Eskimos down at Torrington.
Right.
Torrington. And all right, now, then,
from there I went to the N.A. McNeil Company,
where you and Charlie Fitz were eminently successful and had a successful relationship.
And of course, again, the N.A. McNeil Company goes back to Lime Rock.
Indeed it does.
Because N.A. McNeil started his insurance business in Lime Rock. He owned a large home on Main Street. His insurance office was in the Fenton House. And he became very successful before he moved to Lakeville. As a matter of fact, he went to Millerton first, and then back to Lakeville.
And the name is still in existence, and now it's Wagner and McNeil.
Right. Yeah.
All right, now that brings us through your insurance era. And now, before we close this thing, I want to get a little bit about your long term as assessor, town of Salisbury. When did you start, and about when did you start? How did you enjoy it?
Well, I was asked to be a member of the Board of Assessors the year before Dolph Baumann gave it up. Dolph was anxious to give it up. He wanted a chance to train someone that would be willing to take his place.
I mean, to go out in the field and learn how to really assess a property.
Right. He was, the work of the Board of Assessors had all been pretty much dropped in his lap for quite a few years. The Board of Assessors for a long time was a three-man board, but carried on by one man as a rule who did most of the work. And Dolph Baumann was the man who did most of the work in those days. So I guess it was shortly after I went with the N.A. McNeil Company that Bill Barnett asked me if I would consider taking over a spot on the Board of Assessors and then standing for election at the next town election. Now, again, I'm going to have to do a little guessing here, but it was approximately 1950. Well, it was probably between 1950 and 1955, somewhere in that period. I've got notes at home, of course, that would pin it down, but...
So during that time, you learned the business of assessing, and you became the number one assessor in the town, perhaps the whole area. Is that correct?
That's right. The first year I was on the Board of Assessors, I went to assessor school in Storrs. And from then on, I attended the assessor's school at Storrs for 15 years annually. And again, it got to the point where it could no longer be handled as a part-time job. So I had to make the choice of either giving that up or giving up the N.A. McNeil Company Association. And I really enjoyed the work of the assessor's office. So I made that decision. I decided to go in as full-time assessor, and I gave up my job with the N.A. McNeil Company.
And you stayed at that post for some 20 years, I would think.
Well, I was an assessor in the town of Salisbury, one category or the other, for 24 years.
24 years. And from your first experience as an assessor until the end, you saw a lot of changes made.
A great many. Very many changes.
You saw the town grow.
More complicated.
The assessed valuation grow from what to what?
Well, we had a grand list of 50 million when I left it. When I first started, we had a grand list of approximately 12 men.
Now, I'd like to get your thoughts on the running problem of assessing private schools and such, which is a current problem, not only in the town of Salisbury, but throughout the state. What was your experience along those lines?
Well, I have always been of two opinions as far as private schools and as far as churches were concerned. It always seems to me that a private school, if it is non-profitable, is serving a purpose for the town which is very deserving, and where there is no profit to anyone, should be tax exempt. And the same with churches. However, I've always felt that Connecticut's attitude toward churches was perhaps ideal compared with many other states. The statutes of Connecticut exempted churches, church properties, which were used solely for religious purposes. This was not true of many other states. There are some states that exempt church property per se. In other words, any property owned by a church is exempt. And many churches have taken advantage of this. As an example, they have bought business buildings in some cities, leased them back to the owners, paid no taxes on them, and have enjoyed the profits from it in competition with other property owners in the same business. This has not been true in Connecticut. If a church-owned business property, it is taxable in Connecticut, which is as I think it should be. I think the same thing is true with the private schools. Private schools are serving a purpose which in some respects takes a load off of the town or the state. Except that any property that they own which is not used for their specific educational purposes should be taxed. The problem is, where do you draw the line, you see?
Does this also encompass residences that are occupied by people who work at the private schools, for example?
Right, and this is the bone of contention in most cases, actually. This idea of paying taxes on property that may or may not help to pay its expenses by being leased. is a very small part of the problem. The bigger problem, I think, is the question of whether or not the many residences owned by a school should be tax exempt any more than a home in the village, which is rented by a professor at the school.